The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good morning. This morning I'd like to give a talk based on a discourse from the middle-length discourses. It's a discourse that's called the Discourse to Prince Bodhi. And it's kind of a, I think, a delightful little text, a sutta. Partly because I think it's, even if it was based on historical fact, it's a literary work in that it's composed in a way, the composition is trying to make some points, and I think even in its very subtle way, humorous points, in order to say something important about the Dharma. And when the Dharma teachings are presented within the context of a story, it's important to be careful how we read or relate to the teachings, because many people will forget very quickly that it's part of a story, a context, and will generalize and say, oh, these teachings are supposed to be universally applicable everywhere. And then they have trouble with them. They say, well, you know, it's, you know, maybe not so universal. What about those people in this situation? But rather is to appreciate that these teachings were given to a specific person in a specific context. Maybe they were tailor-made for this person, and they weren't meant to be universal. And if we start with that premise, then what we can ask ourselves, in what way might it be applicable to me? In what way might this be useful for me? Is there some way in which it fits in the context of my life or supportive of my life? And then we can build and benefit from it. But if we rush to the generalization, that this is a universal religious teaching, it's supposed to be applicable everywhere, then it's easy to come up with exceptions and wonder what's going on here. And does this make sense, some sense? Okay. So Prince Bodhi. So even with has concerns this prince who has a conversation with the Buddha. And the very fact that he's called Prince Bodhi maybe highlights that something unusual is going on here. Because Bodhi is the Indian way of saying enlightenment. So he's Prince Enlightenment. And in this story, Prince Enlightenment has just finished building a new palace. And so the Buddha, who went out for his Bodhi, for his enlightenment, he left the palace. And here's Prince Bodhi, who is getting ready to move into his palace. So the contrast, I think, is kind of in the, you know, is there a little bit. And this Prince Bodhi behaves kind of unusually. He claims that he's devout. He's a devout follower of the Buddha. But he doesn't behave that way. So, for example, he decides to, because he's going to have this new palace that he's going to move into, he wants to have a blessing of the palace. He wants to invite the religious figure, the Buddha, to come and give the have a meal there and give the first talk there or something. Not an uncommon event even to this day, that Buddhist monks are invited to, you know, to when some building is built, a house is built, or a temple is built, to come, they come and do something, blessing, have a meal. And so he sends one of his ministers to go to the Buddha with the instructions, when you get to the Buddha, get down and bow your head to his feet 3 times, and then invite the Buddha to come to a meal at my new palace tomorrow. So the Buddha agrees to do this. And when Buddha shows up, Prince Bodhi greets him, where Prince Bodhi does not bow down to his head to his feet. In the story, when he told his minister to do it, he said, in my name, do it. But when he has a chance to see the Buddha directly, he doesn't bother. So this is a little bit, you know, people in the ancient world read this or knew the story. It's like, this is a little odd. And at the end of the teaching he gets, he exclaims, he says this, oh, the Buddha, oh, the Dharma, oh, the Sangha. How great. You know, nowhere else in the sutta does anybody say it that way. And And so his minister says to him, when this was said, his minister, actually, another person said, said to the prince, but you said, oh, the Buddha, oh, the Dharma, oh, the Sangha. You didn't say, I go for refuge in the Buddha. I go for refuge in Dharma. Usually when someone really loves the Buddha's teachings, they declare they go for refuge to him. It's kind of a, so he just says, oh, the Buddha. And then he says, oh, I didn't really have to do it because I've already done it. It was done in my name before I was born, when my mom was pregnant with me, and after I was born, my nursemaid went to the Buddha and declared that I was going for refuge to the Buddha. So it's already been taken care of. In other words, he doesn't have to bow to the Buddha. He doesn't have to declare he goes for refuge to the Buddha. He's just kind of like coasting along on, you know. So it's, you know, it's just kind of the context for the story in a little bit to get the sense. So when the Buddha shows up at this new palace, it turns out that Prince Bodhi has laid out cloth on the steps going into the palace and apparently all over the floor of the palace. And we don't know for sure what this entails, but when the Buddha came there, he refused to walk onto the cloth. He just stood there silently. And his attendant, Ananda, went over to Prince Bodhi and said, you know, you should move those cloth away. He's not going to go into your palace where that cloth is there. And what do people think is going on is that he put the cloth, it was special cloth, and he wanted the Buddha to walk on the cloth to bless the cloth. And so the cloth became somehow imbued with the potency of this great spiritual person, blessings. Maybe some people think it had to do with some kind of fertility belief that somehow maybe he could have, you know, lots of little princes. You know, or something. But not only did the Buddha refuse to do there, but later the Buddha made a rule that his monks can't be part of that kind of ritual and that kind of magic kind of ideas. And here's an example of someone who is not going to go to the trouble to bow to the Buddha, not going to go to trouble to himself go to refuge to Buddha. And he's not going to go to trouble to practice himself to get any benefits from his own practice. He's going to rely on the charisma, the power of the Buddha to kind of be transferred to the cloth so that he could kind of get some magic or get some kind of, you know, something special. So, you know, he says he's a follower of the Buddha. He says he's already gone for refuge to the Buddha. And after the meal that he offers to the Buddha, he asks the Buddha a question. Oh, he says this. He says, not a question, he says, statement. Venerable sir, we have thought thus. Pleasure is not gained through pleasure. Pleasure is to be gained through pain. So the word for pleasure is a very rich word. It probably maybe shouldn't be translated as pleasure here. The word also means happiness. So happiness is not found through happiness. Happiness is found through suffering, pain. And so why this is unusual is in the context of the story is that, he says he's a follower of the Buddha, but this teaching is a teaching of a rival religious group in the time of the Buddha. Of the Jains, who were ascetics, and they felt that you had to kind of exhaust all your bad karma by doing ascetic practices, caused a lot of pain, and then you kind of speed it up, you know, because you have to kind of purify or empty yourself of all the bad karma you've done, and suffering is a good way. You know, because you want to, you know, speed up the suffering rather than all the lifetimes you keep getting reborn and slowly you kind of use it up. But so they kind of believed that pain was really good as part of, so they would do all kinds of self-mortification practices. It's a little bit of a caricature of these other people, But it's kind of how the Buddhist, the context of the story at least. So again, for the audience back in the ancient world, it's kind of strange that this prince would make this statement if he was a follower of the Buddha. So then the Buddha uses the occasion to, as a response to this, to tell his own story. And it's a little unusual, as far as we know, as far as I know, in the history of, you know, the Buddha is one of the first people in recorded history, the records we have, who regularly used his own biography, autobiography, his own story, his own experience as a reference point for his teachings. And I think that not only, I think one of the reasons for that is the Buddha was pointing to a personal experience that people were supposed to have to discover what's true for themselves. And so what's the authority? You don't go to a book for authority, you don't go to the tradition, you don't go to other teachers, you go to your own experience. In the context of his time, it was kind of a radical thing to do, to rely so thoroughly on your own experience. So he was, he gave his story. In the story of his own enlightenment, he describes how he was a very diligent practitioner of asceticism. The stories are pretty dramatic, how as if he left no stone unturned in order to practice asceticism to the nth degree. I think to prove that he did it, you know, you couldn't have done it more than him, because he brings it himself right up against death. He says, if I took a little bit more of this kind of ascetic, I would have died, and there was no point in that. So then some point the Buddha pulls back from all this gruesome ascetic practice that he does. And then, remember, so the statement he's responding to is that the prince believes pleasure is not found from pleasure, or happiness is not found from suffering. Happiness is not found from happiness. Happiness is found from suffering. That's a statement, right? I apologize for jumping around. So the Buddha first describes his practice of suffering, of pain. And the Buddha says it didn't work. And then I was looking for something else, and then I remembered an event from when I was young. People think when he would be 6 or 7, when there was his town, his village, or whatever, was performing the spring spring planting festival, and the first ritual plowing of the fields. And I guess it was a big festive event, and so people had forgotten about the little boy who was sitting at the edge of the field under a rose apple tree, and he just sat there. The image, I think, probably sat there in kind of meditation posture, but sat there and just kind of watching the scene. And in sitting there, got concentrated, got still, got very quiet and peaceful. And in that quiet, peaceful, concentrated state, he had a sense of well-being, of happiness. And I hope that some of you, and not everyone has this, but maybe you have a reference point, sometime when you were a child, that you kind of fell into a contented, peaceful, happy state of being. Sometimes I had it going to sleep at night occasionally, that I would lay there, and I had an experience, when I was a kid, I labeled to myself as the edge of the pillow experience. And I would get very, very peaceful and very kind of contented and happy, just being there cozy and everything. And that was the experience that I forgot until I started being a regular meditator. And then it came back to me. And so something like that happened to the Buddha. He remembered something, a very pleasant sense of well-being, of happiness. And it occurred to him, maybe this is the way forward. And that's when he started his, in earnest, the path that led him to his enlightenment, to his Bodhi. And so this idea of happiness and well-being was key for the Buddha, that opened the door for his liberation. And so then he taught a meditation practice and taught a lifestyle that was meant to bring the sense of well-being, the sense of happiness, that hopefully would then open and deepen a person into these deeper realms that lead to enlightenment. So he used his own story to say that pain is a dead end for leading to happiness, but you can use happiness to lead to happiness. Isn't that nice? So he says that to the prince. And then the prince asks a question. Venerable sir, when a monk finds the Tathagata, the Buddha, to study with him, to learn from him, how long is it until that monk realizes for himself, with direct knowledge, here and now, the supreme goal of the holy life, for with reason for which he went off to become a monk? In other words, once someone becomes a monk, how long does it take for them to get enlightened like you? It's a reasonable question. How long does it take? I'll take a little aside. I have one of my favorite little stories because it's so meaningful to so many people who come to practice. There was a young aristocratic, maybe like a prince, who came to the monastery to be a monk. He was very capable and very, very capable and smart, and could do everything that he put his mind to. He could do really well. And he said to the abbot, "Now that I'm coming to the monastery, how long will it take me if I practice really well and diligently? How long will it take me to get enlightened?" And the abbot said, "Oh, about 10 years." And he said, "Oh, but you know, I have all this capacity. I can really apply myself. If I really try hard and really apply myself and give my full over to it, how long will it take?" And the abbot said, "Oh, in that case, it'll take 20 years. There's something about finding just the right balance of not striving or pushing too much, but being diligent that is required. And so you can't try too much, but you can't try too little either. Anyway, so the prince asked, how long is it going to take? And as the Buddha often did, he doesn't answer directly. Sometimes he would actually ask a counter question in response to a question. And this was his counter question. "As to that, I shall ask you a question in return. Answer it as you choose. What do you think, prince? Are you skilled in the art of wielding a goad, a whip, while riding an elephant?" And the prince says, "Yes, venerable, I am." So in other words, he's a skilled elephant rider. And elephants were important vehicles of war back then, and like a tank, I guess. And and he was skilled. He was a skilled person. And then the Buddha said, "And what do you think, prince? Suppose a person came here thinking, Prince Bodhi knows the art of riding an elephant. I shall train in that art under him. But if that man had no faith, he could not achieve what can be achieved by one who has faith. If he had a lot of illness, if he was really sick, he could not achieve what could be achieved by one who is free of illness. If he is fraudulent and deceitful, he could not achieve what is achieved by one who is honest and sincere. If he is lazy, he could not achieve what can be achieved by one who is energetic. And if he is not wise, he could not achieve what can be achieved by one who is wise. What do you think, prince? Could that man train under you in the art of riding an elephant?" And the prince says, "Sir, even if he had one of these deficiencies, he could not train under me. So what of the five?" So in other words, if you want to learn the art of, I mean, if any of you are interested in becoming a great rider of elephants, you know, it's a, you know, really kind of become skilled at riding elephants, first you have to find someone who's going to teach you. But if you don't have confidence and faith in learning and studying with a great master elephant rider, if you're really, really sick, you know, and if you are full of deceit and, you know, not going to be honest with your trainer, and if you're really lazy, and if you're not wise about what you do, you're probably not going to learn how to do it very well. And Buddha gives this counterexample to Prince Bodhi. But then Buddha goes on to say, "What do you think, Prince? Suppose a person came here thinking, Prince Bodhi knows how to ride elephant. I'll train with him. If he has faith, if he is free of illness, if he is honest and sincere, if he is energetic, and if he is wise, could that person train under you in the art of riding an elephant? And then Prince Bodhi says, "Sir, even if he had only one of those qualities, he could train under me. So what of the five? Even more so were the five." So too, the Buddha continued, so too, there are these five factors of striving. Now, the Bhikkhu Bodhi, it's funny that he's called Bhikkhu Bodhi in the story, but the person who translated this, his name's Bodhi also. He chose the title of, to call this striving. Other people have called this word endeavoring, effort. Without some engagement in a spiritual practice is not going to work. You have to give yourself over to it to some degree, or to a big degree. And so remember, he's answering the question the prince gave him: how long is it going to take for your monks to get enlightened? And so he's going to provide now a conditional response, rather than saying, oh, it's going to take them, you know, a year. You know, everyone's expected in a year. He said, well, it really depends on whether they have these five factors of striving, if they have these five qualities that support their effort. And so he says, so too, Prince, there are these five factors of striving. What five? Here, a monastic has faith. The monastic places faith in the Buddha's enlightenment. The monastic is free from illness and affliction, possessing good digestion that is neither too cool nor too warm, but medium and able to bear the strain of effort. The monastic is honest and sincere and presents oneself as he actually is to the teacher and companions in the holy life. The monastic is energetic in abandoning the unhealthy states of mind and taking on the healthy qualities of mind. And the person is wise. And the person is wise, specifically, about noticing how things arise and pass. Then the Buddha goes on and says, when a person possesses these five factors of striving, then he will get enlightened in 7 years. No, not only 7 years, in 6 years. No, in 5 years. In 4 years. No, in 3 years. 2 years. 1 year. Not just 1 year, Prince. That person practiced this way will get enlightened in 7 months. Not just 7 months. 6 months. 5 months. 4 months. 3 months. 2 months. 1 month. Half a month. Let alone half a month, Prince, even 7 days and nights. But, he goes on, but let alone 7 days, 6 days and nights, 5 days and nights, 4 days and nights, 3 days and nights, 2 days and nights, 1 day and night. Let alone 1 day and night, Prince, when a monastic who possesses these five factors of striving finds a Buddha, and then being instructed in the evening, that person might arrive at enlightenment in the morning. Being instructed in the morning might do so in the evening. Wow. So, in other words, these five factors of striving are really important. So it's kind of nice that this is translated as factors of striving, because I studiously avoided the word striving in my teachings for decades, because I don't like the word striving, because it has a connotation of straining for me and pushing too hard. But maybe it's good to resurrect the word, because there is a kind of striving. Striving also means that it's endeavoring, it's engaging, but it's really engaging for a purpose. And you're striving for a purpose. And the art of it is not to do it in a way that causes suffering, because happiness is not found through suffering. Happiness is found through happiness. So how do you strive? How do you engage? So the very way that you engage has a good feeling, kind of feels good to you, feels satisfying, feels nourishing to you, doesn't feel a burden, doesn't feel stressful to do it. But still, you have to, you know, but also it's not being complacent. You know, it's not giving, oh, you know, if we just relax a lot, everything will be okay. You have to give yourself over to it in a serious way. And I think for someone who's a monastic, the context of the story is the context of a monastic whose very purpose of becoming a monastic, which is a big life decision. I mean, it's not like a minor thing to go off and become a monastic. But the purpose of it is to create the conditions that seemingly are optimal for doing this work of enlightenment in the most efficient, wholehearted way possible. So you're supported by society to do that. So that's a kind of, that's serious, you know, that's really engaging yourself in it. And then to do that in a way that's efficacious, it helps to have these five qualities of striving. And the first is to have confidence, not in the Buddha. What it says here is confident in the Buddha's enlightenment. Now in the original language, it says confident in the Buddha's Bodhi. So Prince Bodhi had confidence in the wrong Bodhi. Prince Bodhi is confident in himself. He's kind of egotistical, self-centered. He's focused on the wrong Bodhi. I think that's part of the humor of this story. And the Buddha then uses the occasion to say, but you have to have confidence in the Buddha's Bodhi if you really want to strive. So the enlightenment of the Buddha, to have confidence, if you don't have confidence that some kind of, some liberation, some profound form of spiritual happiness is possible, if you don't have confidence that it's possible to free your heart from what afflicts it, free it from the suffering, free it and find a deep abiding sense of well-being, then why, you know, you can't really apply yourself wholeheartedly for that purpose. You might apply yourself in practice for other purposes. You might find it useful to do practice like meditation, and certainly useful for other purposes as well. But if you really want to take it all the way, you have to have a strong degree of confidence in that this is possible. There are people like the Buddha and others who have attained a degree or full degree of enlightenment or full enlightenment, and that you have confidence in that, confidence or faith in that possibility. So what do you have confidence in? All of us are engaged in choices that we make, and it's interesting to step back and look and ask yourself, if you look at the primary ways, things, activities you do in your life, where do you give yourself the most time to? What do you have confidence in that you or faith in that you spend so much time doing some of the primary things that you do? And sometimes that question begins putting a serious questioning around what we do, because we have never really reflected very deeply. As people who spend a lot of time watching TV, you know, the statistics of how much Americans watch TV is quite phenomenal. How many hours? So if that's one of the primary activities that Americans do, what does it say about what they have faith in? What they have confidence in? They have confidence in CNN, they have confidence in, you know, Hulu, and they have confidence in, I don't know, is it Dancing with the Stars? I've never seen it, but isn't that, that's where you have your confidence? You know, anyway, so ask the question, where do you have confidence in? And is that something that's worthwhile reflecting deeply about and maybe talking with friends about and really kind of, because it's very easy, I think, for someone who grew up and become an adult and never really engage this question in a deep way and kind of continue with the primary things we do in life as the received wisdom from society or family about what's important, what we should be doing, or life experiences, maybe great disappointments or fear. If you have confidence in fear, then it limits maybe some of the steps you can take in your life, and you play it safe with jobs and people and all kinds of things. So you have a certain kind of confidence in fear and confidence in how, you know, in staying safe. So what do you have confidence in? And what do you have? And if you're interested in the possibility of liberation and freedom, awakening, are there things that you have more confidence in than you have in the possibility of freedom itself and the value of it? And to spend time grappling with this, looking at that, journaling about it, talking to friends about it, really kind of spending time with that kind of question, I think, is really helpful for getting serious and growing up and maturing in this kind of path that the Buddha had to offer. And then free of illness and affliction, possessing good digestion. So be sure you eat your probiotics. So I don't know the context of the story, why the Buddha chose to call this factor of striving. I imagine it's because Prince Bodhi was kind of a dandy. And, you know, he had a big palace built, he probably ate a lot of rich food, he was probably kind of sick. He was probably not so well, you know, because of how his lifestyle. And so probably he walked up the steps to his palace and he huffed and puffed by the time he got to the top. So this is not going to be very helpful for, if you're really going to be serious about practice, to have be so out of shape and maybe sick from that kind of lifestyle. That's what I imagine. And the reason I want to imagine that way is that I don't want to in any kind of way suggest that if a person has an illness, that can get in the way of practice. In some ways it does. It's difficult to practice in certain ways if you're sick, difficult to, you know, practice, stay up late at night practicing, or give yourself all day long to practice like on retreat. But I've known people who have had serious health problems who have practiced much more diligently than people who were healthy. And it's even sometimes it's because of their health challenges that it gives a certain... it gives material for practice. It opens the doors for freedom in an easier way. They have to force to look at themselves, force to find how to work with the limitations that they have. Working with limitations is part of learning to work with your personal limitations is one of the primary doors to deepening a path of liberation. And people who have a lot of limitations sometimes have more doors they get to go through. If you have very little limitations, sometimes things are too easy. Then it's some, you know, there's, you're not up against some of the challenges, up against some of your attachments in the same way. But anyway, being in good shape helps. And I suspect that if the Buddha lived in modern America, he would have had a ninefold path to liberation, not an eightfold path. And the ninth factor that he would have slipped in there somewhere is right exercise. Because he would have read, you know, he would have been on the computer occasionally, and he would have read some of these studies that go on about obesity and people out of health, statistically, in this country. And he would have said, this is not helpful. And so right exercise is important as right speech and the right action and all that. And it helps, you know, you get good vitality and energy going that supports you in the practice. And then being honest and sincere. The way it's described, it's very interesting. So a factor of striving is being honest and sincere, and the person reveals him or herself to the teacher and to companions in the practice. So in other words, you don't stay all private and closed up, but you're willing to share yourself and let other people know who you are, what's going on with you. You're honest about yourself. So if you have challenges, if you have difficulties, if you let them know who you are, not everyone, you know, but please spare us about all the details. It can be done too much, but if you're not honest to your teacher, if you're not honest to the people who are going to support you in the practice, then they can't guide you, they can't offer you feedback, they can't offer you support. And if you're trying to be the good Buddhist and trying to behave just right and appear like a good Buddhist, but inside you're seething, you know, inside you have all these struggles and difficulty, then that's going to be a limitation. You're not going to be able to keep growing and developing. It's the willingness to be open and honest to your teachers, open to, this is who I am, kind of like, you know, here I am, I'm presenting myself to you. And it's one of the great things to have people come and present themselves to a teacher fully and honestly who they are. Say, this is the material I'm working with. this is what I got, and what do you have to do? How do you? How can I practice? How? What support can I get? What? Do you have any advice for me? This is what you know. And you know, one of the great stories. I don't know if it's great, but it made an impression on me many years ago at the San Francisco Zen Center. There was a man who came to the teacher there and said that he was addicted to heroin. And the teacher said to him, "Thank you for telling me. And the only thing that I want from you is I want you to come and show up for meditation every day." He didn't say stop. He didn't criticize him. He didn't blame him. But he said, "I want you to come." And it turned out that was like so helpful for this man. The fact that he was not condemned, the fact that he was not ostracized or told that he was a terrible person, but he was given this regularity, like do this every day, and that helped him overcome his heroin addiction. Isn't that great? So you know, so if you're a heroin addict, you're welcome to tell me. So this willingness to reveal yourself to at least some people. That's what honesty and sincerity means here. And then energetic. In abandoning the unhelpful states of mind and undertaking helpful states of mind. So this means you don't passively go along with whatever state of mind you happen to wake up with in that morning, whatever comes along. But you have some choice about what states of mind that you operate under. Within limits, right? You can't have a lot to do with it. But if you're walking down the street, or you go in some place, and you're grumpy, you have a choice about whether you continue acting grumpy or you try to call forth in an honest way, that sincere, expressions maybe of goodwill to some of the people you run into. It's more useful if you can honestly and sincerely bring forth goodwill, think about it. If you're grumpy and you're thinking about all grumpy thoughts and how you're justified to be grumpy, guess what you continue being? Grumpy. But if you engage in some thoughts about, wow, these people I'm with, they spend a lot of time helping me, and look at that, they're having a hard time, or they're supporting me, or whatever, then perhaps you're more likely to have a feeling of goodwill. Within reason, it's possible to have some say about what direction you're feeding your mind, how you're developing your mind, exercising your mind. And this ability to start exercising your mind, your heart, in certain directions is part of the right striving. You don't just accept how you are. You can change within reason some of the states of mind, qualities, activities that you do. So they're more supportive for this practice. And here it says one is energetic in this regard. And then finally, the last factor of striving is the person is wise. And here it's very interesting that the definition of wisdom is very simple. The person is wise regarding the arising and disappearance of things. The person sees really well that this the impermanent nature of this world. That's how wisdom is defined here. That somehow the understanding that things come and things go. There's something about that insight that the Buddha held up as one of the highest forms of insight that he had to offer. You could think that maybe that's kind of silly. It's not so, you know, not so noble. You know, you talk to your neighbors. You know, belong to some other religion or other spiritual tradition, psychological work they do, and they say, "Well, you're a Buddhist, and you know, what's the greatest form of wisdom that you have to offer?" "Oh, I see that things arise and pass." You know, like like maybe you feel a little embarrassed even to tell them, like they have great things. But there's something extremely useful and significant that affects the heart and the psyche about seeing the arising and passing of things. There's something about seeing the impermanence of this life that is key to helping the heart become free, helping this bodhi, this enlightenment. And maybe that I'll save that for another time. Maybe next time I come here I can give a talk on that. But right now, just appreciate that to understand the impermanent nature of life at all the different levels or scales of impermanence, over a lifetime, over the day, over the minute, over the second, is really key to this path to awakening. So these five factors of striving, of efforting, of endeavoring, and it's probably relevant in any endeavor you're engaged in, whether you want to learn how to ride elephants, or you want to learn how to a new craft, learn a new skill, language, anything that you're going to do, learn to cook a new dish, or if you want to engage in any kind of spiritual practice, including, you know, the path to awakening. These five things are really helpful, these five aspects of striving. And it might be interesting for you to consider the things that you do, already doing perhaps, and consider them through through these five categories. To what degree do I have faith or confidence as I do this? To what degree am I healthy as I do this? Do I have energy for doing it? My digestion supports this. To what degree am I sincere and honest as I do this? And to what degree do I cultivate the helpful states of mind that support this endeavor? And to what degree am I wise about, just wise, but for the Buddhist, for the path of awakening, wise about arising and passing, wise discerning. So five factors of striving. So, and those of you who are interested in practice or meditate or practice in some sincere way, I think I would recommend in particular that you reflect on these five. How does this work for you, and how can these apply to you in a way that's supportive and helpful? So, and then you can say, "Oh, the Buddha! Oh, the Dhamma!" So, thank you.